This is hi everybody. This is an Alan Smithy podcast. I'm Matt. I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write for thestopbutton.com.
And we talk about a bad movie and a good movie. And this week we're talking about Rooftops, a bad movie, and Matinee by Joe Dante, our good movie. Rooftops is by Robert Wise. It came out in '89, and I wasn't familiar with anyone in the cast, but you chose this because it killed off someone's career, right?
Well, I mean, it killed off, you know, I remember Jason Gedrick's career as a 10-year-old would, or 9 even. So it's like, I think after Iron Eagle, he was big shit, because Iron Eagle was a video hit, I think. Like, it was really popular. They made another one, like... Mm. And I think it might have. It came out in the theater. I saw Iron Eagle 2 in the theater when I was 12. So
what about Aces?
Aces was direct to video. And Sonny Chiba is in Aces. So some people, you know, like Quentin Tarantino, I'm sure has the 35mm print of it. But Rooftops was, I mean, you know. In the way people talked about movies before there was Entertainment Weekly or what's that one with Mary Hart and John Tesh?
Entertainment Tonight.
You know, it was one of those things that, you know, had a buzz about it because it was the guy from Iron Eagle in a lead role. And, I mean, if you look at the, well, not if you look at the writer of Rooftops, who was a consultant on some movie in the 70s, and that's the only other thing he did, and it seems to have been produced by a couple record company people or something, and the soundtrack seems to be a big deal, but Taylor Hackford was the executive producer, and I'd never heard of New Visions Pictures.
Yeah, they have a very cheesy logo. It's a flag of indeterminate origin flapping in front of a sweeping mountain vista or something.
Yeah, so I looked them up, and they only ever released Rooftops, and the rest of the stuff they did, they produced, they were just a production company for Taylor Hackford's movies. They were the production company for White Nights and some of his other big ones and some of the stuff that he produced in the early 90s, and then they kind of disappeared. And so I'm thinking the only reason that Rooftops was a New Visions Pictures release was because they couldn't get a studio to release this movie in 89. I mean, they couldn't sell it. I mean, you know, just try imagine taking this to Cannes and being like, hey, like, we got 85 minutes plus credits of goodness here.
Yeah, it's really kind of mechanically assembled. It has a pretty strong MTV influence, and it's odd to see that on Robert Wise, who directed great movies like The Haunting and West Side Story, and The Sound of Music. So, you know, the musical background comes through too, but there's just something about the way, like, it'll go from a scene of the gang leader Eddie Velez threatening somebody to training scenes of this fighting style that incorporates dance that Jason Gedrick is doing, and then back to quasi-serious stuff. It wants to have this gritty urban realism, but it's kind of feels like The Warriors with some acrobatics included. I was wary from the opening credits where there was a choreography credit.
Yeah, I saw that too.
I thought, what kind of choreography? And well, it wasn't even something I could have expected, because it's set up so early in the movie as like, yo, there's this new style that's out. It's like, you know, dance style that's also fighting, and sometimes it almost becomes an action movie like that. Sometimes it almost is. It's like they're running around on rooftops, obviously, and you have the chase that starts the movie with the opening credits, and then three hoods chase the kid Squeak up on the rooftops, and they don't know how to be on the rooftops, so they fall through holes, and that's at the end of a long chase sequence. So it's juggling a lot of stuff, really. A lot of moods, I guess you could say, haphazardly, because there's also like dancing and extensive soundtrack tie-in, like you were saying.
Well, it kind of, I mean, yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Warriors because of the New York locations. I mean, could they have, they use the World Trade Center so much, it's almost like it's a backdrop, like a painted backdrop that they just put there to show that they were really in New York. But it's also like a mix of The Wiz, you know, because it's this, I guess Roger Ebert complained about that too, that it glamorizes being homeless.
Right. It's one of those, it's one of those kinds of movies. Exactly.
And if you listen to the songs, it's like, you know, I could have a house, but I'd rather live on the rooftops of New York City. And you're just kind of like, wait.
Yeah. And we're making it sound like it is a musical, which it isn't per se, like no one sings, but the relentless soundtrack and
the dancing, overall,
the dancing and the song that glamorizes it is at the very end during the credits. Some guy rapping about rooftops is the place to be.
But there's also the song, the first song at the party is about rooftops and how they're the place to be. But I think that was by a woman. I think I intended at some point during the movie to check the credits to see who they got for the original soundtrack, but I couldn't like muster the, I mean, this is the worst thing we've watched since we started doing this. I mean, by far, this is the worst thing I've said. I mean, this might have been worse than X-Men 2. Like, I can't remember the last time I sat through anything this bad. Like, I'm just like, oh, wow, I really shouldn't have recommended this. This is just atrocious. Because it's not even amusing to talk about it in terms of Robert Wise, because it's tragic that his career ended on this, that, like...
Yeah, was this in a TV movie?
I saw that, and I hope the TV movie was better. Like, really do, because this one, oh, it's just like, there's not a single nice thing you can really say about it. I think it's even poorly edited, like...
Well, you know, the girl's ass was hot. You can say that about it.
Troy Bear, yeah. Weekend of Bernie's 2, Troy Bear. It did get me looking her up because she directed some movies in the mid or late 90s that were apparently NC-17 or something and for language and that sort of thing. But my interest waned in that too.
I guess it's also for Louis Guzman fans.
Yes. Yes.
He has a small role in this as the kid with the jacket's abusive stepdad.
Well,
speak.
You think he's the abusive stepdad, but maybe after that second scene, he's not that bad. He's just a guy.
Yeah.
Because the mom loves him, man. She doesn't want him to leave. And that's when, you know, it's getting into its really awful social commentary.
Well, what's social commentary? It's just like they're adding drama upon drama, and then I think it's like shortly thereafter, they must have been like, this character's storylines are getting too emotionally complicated to resolve. Let's just kill him. And then, like, after he's killed, the movie's almost over, and Jason Gedrick barely has time to react to the death of his friend.
Who he doesn't really like.
I mean, yeah.
the kid, I mean, that's the thing, is the squeak kid is this, you know, annoying hanger-on. And he
could have wandered off of the Lost Boys sets of Hook, almost.
Yeah, especially with that jacket. So he's kind of actually, and he's not homeless, he's like a hanger-on to the homeless crowd. And I mean, that is kind of interesting that they never, Jason Gedrick's character, whose name is T, it's just T,
Yeah, the letter, yeah.
Yeah, even credited as the letter. I thought he was going to have, like, some sort of talent that was going to get him off the rooftops and not being homeless anymore, now that he ends the movie with a non-homeless girlfriend. but no, instead, like, it ends in a celebration of homelessness.
Dancing and homelessness. That's the best part, is that, like, also early in the movie, he goes to... they're at the party, and it seems like a fight's going to break out. And then suddenly it's like Robert Wise's West Side Story, because ordinarily where people would get shanked, there's dancing. And it really is dancing, because they do this bizarre fight where no punches connect, and they're just swinging around like circus acrobats. And that's how they resolve it. It's like expecting to believe that if you saw, I don't know, if you saw a movie in like 94 where in the ghetto real hood rats settled their differences by playing snaps and Yo Mama. Like that, like if that were real. That's kind of the stretch of imagination they're asking us with Rooftops.
And that fight scene, the fight scene is, the other character's not supposed to be gay, but basically he's really buff and they seem to have him oiled up in every single scene. And they plan
you mean
as
the
a
guy with the poofy hair.
Yeah, the guy with the poofy hair. Because at the end, he's supposedly it's implied he's going to get together with Tisha Campbell, even though she was with Jason Gedrick until he met Troy Baer, which is all very complicated. And I mean, when you look at this movie, the most successful person on it is Tisha Campbell because she gets to cash all those checks from whatever you call them, residuals from the Martin show. You know, like nobody else gets to do that. Nobody else was on a successful TV show. I mean, Jason Gedrick actually, he was on a really good show called Easy Streets that lasted 7 episodes. I think he's done, but he's done like crappy stuff like The Last Don 1-6 or however many they've had, that TV movie based on the Puzo. And I think he's like, I think around the time of Easy Streets, which was 96-97, he started getting some respect, and he sort of just used that to get paying gigs. And so I don't think he's ever tried to act again. And, I mean, to be fair, he was in Iron Eagle, so it's not like he was trying to act in the first place. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of the whatever happened to this guy, and he was in Rooftops. And the thing was, in Iron Eagle 2, he's at the very beginning and he dies. Because, you know, he was filming Rooftops at the time. And it's kind of like, wow. Iron Eagle, even though it's not a canon movie, it's kind of like the canon version of Top Gun or something. You know, it's incredibly jingoistic and just sort of absurd. And I don't know.
As radical fighter jets.
I don't know. Lou Gossett Jr. is probably good in it. I mean, he's always fine.
I like sequels where one of the main characters from the last one was filming something and they just do a cameo. Like Revenge of the Nerds 2, Anthony Edwards is filming Johnny Be Good or something. So he shows up at the beginning and he has the one good joke in the movie that he broke his leg doing a difficult move in a chess match.
Or Corey Feldman in whichever Friday the 13th he was filming the Goonies.
Oh, yeah, 5. Right.
They don't do that anymore. They just recast them as opposed to killing people off in great ways in the first 5 minutes and then.
Or Amy Steele in Friday the 13th, part two. Or the girl from the first one, Adrienne King.
Yeah.
They stab her in the head in the first few minutes, which I always thought was kind of ballsy.
Well, it makes you wish that. Wow, we're really not talking about Rooftops. But this is a great observation. Like, Hannibal, you know, what if they'd killed off Jodie Foster at the beginning?
Right.
But done it through, like, recutting footage they owned from the first one? Or something just idiotic like that? Or, you know, got Ed Norton to film a, like, 2-minute scene of dying at the beginning of that they could insert into the DVD special edition of Silence of the Lambs after they made Red Dragon? I mean, just, you know, they really ought to just push it with the whole CG thing. Just make it absurd. But Rooftops.
Rooftops.
Back to Rooftops. And I think we're going to have a lot of tangents on this one.
A lot of what?
Tangents. We're not going to be able to stay on Rooftops
for a while. Well, you know, I liked the cheesy New York, like, ADR. I guess Larry Cohen was in charge of the ADR because he hears stuff like, "Hey, let's go to Luigi's. I had Chinese last week."
Now, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm not sure where Rooftops takes place. Because it's not Manhattan.
Well, the opening song confused me because they're talking about, you know, Alphabet City, like Avenue A.
Yeah, and that's nowhere near where they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They seem to be somewhere in Brooklyn. Yeah. But it's not ever, nobody mentions anything by name ever.
But it's sort of this interesting, the portrayal of New York is the worst portrayal of it, I think, since Fort Apache, the Bronx, which essentially was, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but Fort Apache, the Bronx is actually one of the things that made them clean up the Bronx in the 80s, because, like, you know, it's this movie where, you know, young mothers go hang out in front of the go hang out in the police station so they can get murdered and stuff. I mean, it's just awful. Like, it's just urban hell. And then, yeah, like, you know, the story is
this
that
is, yeah,
they had to clean it up a little because nationwide audiences were kind of like, wait a second. But this is just, like, burnout buildings. Nobody has a... Wait, Troy Barrow has a home, but she's also, like, a lookout for her cousin, who there's,
yeah,
like,
drug,
some...
Yeah, for Eddie Velez, her drug-dealing cousin, Lobo.
And there's some quasi-inappropriateness to their relationship where I'm surprised it didn't go that way. But that would have added 5 minutes to the running time, and I'm sure...
I think they, you know, they needed those extra 5 minutes for the 10 minutes of dancing at the end.
The dancing at the end reminded me of the Elvis movie.
Right.
Because, you know, they had the three songs, and this was like the entire cast, like, comes out and dances.
It's like the credits could be running over this, but they're not. They
including
they want
the instructor.
They want you to take it all in.
Yeah, including the instructor of Kepa, Kepa, the Brazilian thing, who presumably isn't homeless. Like, mm-hmm, that guy's hanging out with the homeless kids to make them feel better about being homeless. And I was half expecting the cop to show up. You know, the cop who, you know, this was an accident.
Right. Well, the, oh yeah, he's another great New York cliche character. Like, the cop who wants to help, and he says, like, you know, hey kid, you know, you and me, you could help me bring this guy down, you know, just keep sending in the tips. And then nothing becomes of it. But it's just a, yeah.
I mean, does the movie really have any subplots? It kind of doesn't.
No, I mean, stuff, yeah, I mean, because, like, stuff happens, but there's not much significance over and over. Like, even when you see the characters' home lives, it doesn't leave an impact because next scene will be another disassociated, you know, occurrence. And then, man, nothing really, it's just, the whole movie is like a montage. That's what I meant by, like, the MTV style. It feels like Robert Wise just caving into that a lot, because he's doing a movie for a record company, after all, and it's 1989.
It's possible that it got chopped in editing. I mean, not that it was ever going to be good, but that maybe it didn't feel like that when he shot it. But who knows? I mean, Wise, his glory period was kind of the mid to late 50s and 60s, really?
Yeah, and then his output was really increasingly sporadic through the 80s and...
Or the 70s.
70s and, yeah. 70s and 80s, yeah.
So, but there's the one weird scene where you see Tisha Campbell's mother, who's a crack whore? Or is this pre-crack? It's crack, because that's,
yeah,
what Lobo's selling, sorry. And her pimp is this kind of mid-50s gray-haired white guy, which is weird. the movie's whole thing on... I mean, actually, if you were trying to find something to compliment the movie on, you could say it was totally racially indifferent. I mean, it was just, you know, there's absolutely no whatever.
Yeah.
It's like Tom Cruise. It's colorblind. It doesn't see color.
There's interracial relationships, but it's never, that's never an issue, even within the story.
And that's kind of absurd when you think about, but anyway, I mean.
But in terms of
reality, but.
but in terms of, you know.
So that scene where you find out that Tisha Campbell used to be her mom turned her into a hooker.
Uh-huh.
You find that out, and then the only time it ever comes up again is when she's, like, trying to seduce the guy that she's, like, the trap for at the end during the action sequence. And I mean, it's just like, I'm sitting there going, did they actually waste this scene so I could believe that Tisha Campbell could be, like, coming on to this guy? Like, you know, just...
Yeah. I like how near the end they keep, you know, they keep up the whole rooftops theme by having the kid Squeak dangled from rooftops before he gets thrown off of a rooftop to his death. Spoiler alert. And Jason Gedrick has a story about his little sister falling from a height, right, and hitting a electrical wire.
No, that's his mom.
That's his mom, yeah. So there's a big keep up the theme of, I don't know, being up on top of everything.
They totally should have done that.
It's not even like there's a coherent metaphor or anything for living on the rooftops, and they don't really justify why it's where they. I mean, should they be squatters?
They are squatters.
Is it just because they're in New York, they're in Brooklyn, that they're on rooftops?
You know what that rooftop song at the end reminds me of? It reminds me of the theme from Arthur. You know, it's an upbeat, cheery song about living in New York.
Yeah.
On one hand, you're a, you know, multi-millionaire inheritee, and on the other hand, you're the homeless guys who have fun and dance. And the other thing is, he lives on the rooftops. They all live on the rooftops. You never really see them spending 15 minutes walking to the rooftops.
Yeah. You only see the kid run up to the top at the beginning, and then anytime else they want to be on the rooftops, they pretty much teleport up there.
Well, I think the one at the beginning, he went up the fire escape, and it didn't seem that high of a roof. Like, I was surprised, I guess, would be the word, when I discovered that the building... Well, that's the whole, you know, drama, is that Lobo and T are fighting for this building. And, I mean, that would have been totally fine, you know. It was after Die Hard. They could have done a whole dancing, fighting thing.
It's funny how they're fighting over the building itself. Like, buildings are so important in this movie. And I just discovered that... We were saying that there, you know, the song is about how rooftops are where it's at.
Well, yeah.
Tagline is rooftops. It's the only place to be. Really makes it sound inviting. Wow, this is gonna be a good time, fun movie, and it is.
I mean, you know, the annoying kid dies. I mean, that kid's really annoying. I was hoping he'd die at the beginning. I was hoping he'd be Jason Gedrick's brother, and they'd knife him, and that's why Jason Gedrick would be mad. I mean. Obviously. But no, I mean, the other thing is, the guy who played the main villain at the beginning, the chasing villain, that guy looked familiar to me. Like, I think he's been in other stuff in similar roles. I'll never be able to think of what it is.
Not since Bill Paxton in The Terminator.
But,
as a punk been portrayed. But, yeah.
I kept thinking they were going to come back at the end, and, like, it was just going to be like they were going to catch up with the kid, because they kind of stopped looking for him. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems like if they were a tough gang,
they would not. I think they probably went back to Manhattan, because that's where they have their initial altercation, right?
Well, that's implied, but, I mean, we don't know that that's where they had their... Because he seemed to have run there, like, you know, really fast. I mean, the geography of this movie is almost as... You've never seen Staying Alive, have you?
No.
We'll watch that as a bad movie sometime.
This movie's geography of New York is worse than Escape from New York's.
Yeah, and Escape from New York makes up bridges. But at least it's for cinematic reasons. So, no, I mean, in Staying Alive... John Travolta walks from Manhattan, like, 10 minutes later, gets to wherever he grew up in Brooklyn or something, and it's just kind of like, whatever.
Well, that's part of the, you know, the Warriors thing of, you know, just foot power. Just run it. If you can't get on the subways, you can just run everywhere.
Well, this one has a motorcycle scene. Now, let's...
Yeah, where does he get that motorcycle?
He borrows the motorcycle from that guy... Or does he rent it? Because T gets all of his money from selling copper. And I'm watching it going, wow, man, this is like... This predates The Wire by like 15 years.
Yeah.
Which, you know, gave me 2 seconds of amusement thinking about how, you know, I really wish I'd been a major newspaper TV reviewer for The Wire, and I could have made a Rooftops reference that would have thrown everyone.
But, yeah, like what's
See, I think people should know what this is. I mean, they shouldn't see it. We usually tell people to see the bad movies. There's no reason to see this. It's not even fun. I mean...
No, I mean, I could recommend it over Funland, I guess.
No, because Funland, you can at least sit there and go, wow, this is so cheap. Wow. Look, it's the same set as that. Hey, it's Jan Hooks. This one, it's kind of like... You know, I was so mad when Wikipedia didn't have any trivia for it. Because there's got to be a story to it. There's got to be like, hey, yeah, somebody was going to pay for this,
famous,
and then they didn't.
Flops, book or something. Yeah, IMDb's only trivia is that it's the final theatrical film by Robert Wise. Like, no shit. I'm going to look that up myself.
But yeah, I mean, because the whole New Visions Pictures thing, it seems like there has to be a story behind this. And I guess Taylor Hackford, I don't know if there's a book about Taylor Hackford, whatever. I swear I knew a girl who went to graduate school with a girl who'd been in film school for undergrad, and she like had met Robert Wise. But I wasn't sure because I'm like, oh, Robert Wise. Because she was telling me this story about driving him from the airport. And she's like, oh, Bob Wise. And I'm like, oh, Robert Wise, you know. And it was like kind of topical because he just died and she seemed upset about it or something. And I'm like, oh, Robert Wise. And she's like, no, Bob Wise. And so I was just kind of, uh-huh, okay. And like looking up. There are no, like, directors named Bob Wise. So,
yeah,
I still have no idea what the hell she was talking about. But, you know, maybe Robert Wise talked about it at some point. But
can you name one more movie that has a more realistic depiction of New York? I'll go with Street Trash as a more realistic depiction of Brooklyn.
I didn't say realistic.
What?
I didn't say realistic.
It's not realistic.
Right. I said less realistic.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. It's my name.
No, but, what are you keeping?
It's such a, yeah.
I knew this was going to be a problem. How far in are we? We're over halfway. Yeah. Rooftops, yeah. We're done. So sad. Jason Getrich should have made Iron Eagles 2, and then he could have romanced the Russian girl instead of the Russian guy romancing the American girl or whatever the hell happens. Okay, moving on.
Yeah. So, don't see Rooftops. But you should see Matinee. And by the way, if you're in the Los Angeles area, the New Beverly Cinema, newbevcinema.com, is playing a new print of Matinee. This Sunday and Monday, and Joe Dante is hosting it. He's hosting a bunch of movies there. I'm going to be seeing St. Valentine's Day Massacre and Not of This Earth on a double bill together, and Roger Corman's going to be there too this Friday. I'd seen this movie first when I was like 8, and I saw it on video shortly after it had been in theaters, and I really liked it then, and before I like knew who Joe Dante was, really, even though I was a huge Gremlins fan, didn't really know it was the same guy. And I haven't seen this movie like since then, basically, but I always remembered it. And it's one of Joe Dante's best, and also I think one of the best movies about the love of movies. It was made like 1 year before Ed Wood, and they're probably just as good in terms of expressing that, I think.
Yeah, and I never saw it. This is the first time I've seen it, and I remember we talked about it back when we started the podcast, because I found that copy of the Mant footage that's, I guess, only on the Laserdisc that somebody put up. But I remember when it came out, because my dad was interested in it, because it's a Cuban Missile Crisis movie, and there are only, I think, two of those that I can think of.
Yeah, and, 13 days on television and whatever.
Yeah, and so it's a very weird, I mean, it bombed, right?
Right.
And I can't understand it not having critical support, because I wasn't thinking about it in terms of Ed Wood, which did have critical support, because this is, I don't think I've ever seen anybody use a cast of kids better than I've seen Dante sort of use them in this. And it's interesting because you can see that it's kind of made by the same guy who made Gremlins and even Small Soldiers, and the way he treats the relationships between the teenagers and young adults.
The screenwriters are the same as Gremlins 2, I believe.
Yeah, I saw that. And that guy also wrote Tex, which I have like an odd affection for, even though I haven't seen it in like 15 years. But he hasn't really done very much, and it's too bad, he should do more. But
yeah, the screenplay is really brilliant overall.
Because it's so, it's so hard to explain. It's just like I got done watching it and I felt like telling everybody to see it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's just, because I just watched it tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was going to do a double feature of it in Rooftops yesterday, and I couldn't do anything after Rooftops except just sort of bemoan the last half hour and a half of my life, or however long it took me to get through it. But see, Matinee is so interesting just because it's this weird sort of, it's kind of like how an adult who didn't have the access to, I guess, the internet or movie books would remember growing up in the sort of atomic age of science fiction, because it mixes the universal horror with William Castle.
Yeah,
and it's just, it's just, I mean, I don't know.
When it's John's, really, what about John Goodman?
No, well, John Goodman's great, but I wasn't going to say that. But when I realized it was John Sayles and Dick Miller, and I was just like, okay, Dick Miller, I was expecting. But John Sayles, I wasn't. But somehow that makes perfect sense that John Sayles is in this.
Sure. Yeah, he's a bit part actor in some movies. He was in The Howling.
Well, he wrote The Howling.
Right, and he has a bit part as
the Undertaker. And he has the great bit part as the Undertaker.
He wrote Piranha also. I think John Goodman, you know, this is one of those movies. I mean, because this is 93. It was still, you know, like, King Ralph era, right? But this is the role that gives him, this is like a comic role that gives him, you know, a little bit more dramatic gravity. And I think like even the Big Lebowski does that too. And when he gets parts that are funny but kind of allow him to be an actor also, he goes from being like a decent quote unquote comic actor to just like a great overall actor. And he's really great in this.
Yeah, and in this one, it's so interesting because,
like, movies like this show that he can like star in a movie. Pretty much, he can be a star of a movie. He's a leading man. Oh, like Barton Fink does the same too.
Yeah. Well,
it's in that mold of, I mean, it's, you know, to varying degrees, right? Because he's varying degrees of crazy in that and Big Lebowski. He's not really crazy in this, but well. He's charismatic.
It's he's kind of just weird in terms of looking at his career, because, you know, I think Roseanne probably hurt him more than it helped him in some ways, because stuff like King Ralph and what was the other one? Wasn't there another one like King Ralph? They kind of like tried to turn him into John Candy.
Right. Yeah.
And that's really, it's kind of a weird thing to think about.
John Candy wasn't even a good John Candy.
Yeah, so I mean,
you look at him on SCTV and he's actually funny. You look at his movies and uniformly horrible.
It's kind of weird that when you think about the 90s, in the late 80s, that there still was a part for the fat guy that they were that Hollywood was trying to fill, and so they tried to they filled it with John Candy, and then he died, or he got less popular, and then he died.
John Goodman, Chris Farley, Jim Belushi.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like it's incredible that there was this part for them, and this is a part that's been around forever. As
the fat dad. Well, I guess we still have Kevin James, and you know, it's never really gone away.
And you know, we have Family Guy and The Simpsons still, right? And it's just kind of it's been around. It's
Bernie Mac, Cedric the Entertainer, I think, or yeah. Doughy Dads.
It's the unsung American film archetype since because it's been around since 1910.
Let's talk about Matinee though, because
well, I was actually going to go into how in Matinee, John Goodman's sort of enormous size, and I feel bad about that because I know like the guy struggled with it, like he wanted to lose weight because he had a kid or something in the 90s. But he's so full of life in Matinee, it's hard to think of him as anything except exuberant. He seems like a huge baby, and that's kind of like
his hands are like leather faces; they're gigantic.
There's this great line in the movie where the main character, and that's one of the other weird things about Matinee, is that it's sort of about three or four people. I'd say three. It's about Stan, Gene, and John Goodman's character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about these three, and it's not, you know, split off in any interesting way. They're not tied together in any sort of Magnolia or Nashville way. It's just this organic progression of the script, and it's a, you know, sort of around an event, which is really interesting. And it got me looking up Charles Haas the second the movie ended. There's this great line, that great line about how, you know, the kid says to him, it's like adults don't have to be grown ups or something. And Kathy Moriarty, who was on her comeback, you know, kind of as Goodman's girlfriend, is unhappy about that. But you know, in terms of being able to love the movies, the sort of atomic sci-fi age movies that Joe Dante obviously loves, you kind of need to have the exuberance of a grown-up kid. And John Goodman somehow manages to be a grown-up kid who knows that he's a grown-up kid and knows the responsibilities of being a grown-up kid in this. And that's the strange thing about it, is that he understands, this movie understands the whole keeping people scared during times of tension thing that came up a lot.
It has some, I mean, on, I remember a lot of things from it, but one of the things I discovered watching it again was kind of the complicated things that it has to say politically about how movies reflect our fears of the times. Because, you know, the main character, the main kid, Gene, who's, you know, all the child actors in this movie are fantastic. Gene is Simon Fenton. His dad's in the Navy, and they're the whole reason, you know, what the movie hinges on is the town where John Goodman's opening Mant. It's on the Florida coast during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the story takes place within a few days. Like, it takes place within 1 week, in which that happens historically, and this movie opens, and the way it ends on, like, the girl who he starts going out with, Sandra, played by Lisa Jacoub, I guess, like, she's got the great scene where she's refusing to do the duck and cover drill, and then, like, afterwards, Gene's talking to her, and she's, you know, she's spouting off this, you know, stuff about, you know, you can't dehumanize the Russians. It's like we're dehumanizing the black kids who have to go to a different school here. And then he says, like, well, you know, my dad's at the base right now. And, like, she backs down. She goes, like, oh, you know, I'm sorry. I, you know, didn't mean it like that. And then you know, her, and then like later on details, you know, like she's got these hippie parents who are supporting the, you know, the right for kids to see this horror movie because they were duped into the con of that Lawrence Woolsey was pulling with the fake protesters for Citizens of Morality to not go, to get people not go to the movie. It's got, it's, and then it ends, it all ends with a shot of the military helicopter flying across the beach with the music Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Presumably with his father coming home, is what I thought of that. But it's so, it's so subtle for a movie that's about, scaring the crap out of people by buzzing their seats. And it's sort of this, you can tell that, well, it kind of reminded me of Radio Days, the Woody Allen one set in the 30s. And it reminded me of Radio Days and Radio Flyer. And I've never seen Radio Flyer, but there was that period at the early 90s when directors like Joe Dante and Richard Donner were able to, you know, get some studio money behind these pet projects of theirs, and Donner made Radio Flyer, which I guess was crappy and something and whatever. And
I have a friend who loves it, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I mean, they pretend they can fly or something, like whatever. I feel that's terrible to say because it's about, you know, an abusive stepfather, right? But and then Dante gets to make Matinee, and it doesn't look cheap at all.
No.
So he obviously got some money for it. I mean, there is a huge action sequence at the end that you can
see. Which is, like, unexpected, but still organic, crazily enough.
And it works so well because the expectations of the movie are so realistic. And I think that that's a very organic way of doing it, and maybe they get some leeway because the Mant movie is so unrealistic by contrasting the movies of the 50s and or the 60s with sort of reality. They get a little bit of leeway, but it's such a beautifully done action sequence at the end, and we really can't spoil it because there is some actual tension in it.
Yeah, and it's an action sequence in the sense of, like, It's the best, like, scenes. You know how Tim Burton used to be good at, like, sequences of chaos?
Right.
Like, it's not really action, like, you know, punches and kicks, but it's like a sequence of chaos that builds, and Joe Dante does it incredibly at the end of Matinee.
And it follows this profound scene between two Simon Fenton and Lisa Jacobe. I really don't want to spoil it because people should see it because I haven't seen this. And it's like the first, I got done seeing it, and the first thing I was like, I gotta email my friend, tell him to see this movie. Like, you know, how did we miss this? Because it's been around for 17 years, 16 years.
My theory is that, like, it's such a great movie about kids, and it's kind of, and it's a kids movie too, but it's, you know, it deals with these very, you know, life and death, war and peace, you know, young love kind of things. But it's so heavy on the kids, but it succeeds so well. It makes that, you know, it's good quality, you know, makes it an asset. But I think the fact that it takes place in the early 60s and it was made in 93, I think that was slightly after the era of, like, nostalgic pieces from recognized directors about the childhoods in the 50s or early 60s, like, you know, Stand By Me or The Wonder Years, which ran, you know, which I think was over by 93. And it really evokes, which, you know, it's too bad because it really evokes its period. It's filmed on location in Florida, and it's filmed on the Universal Studios lot. And, of course, you know, Joe Dante used the Universal lot in Hollywood so well on Gremlins to create the atmosphere of a, you know, self-contained and alive small town, you know, an organic community. He does it just as well here, and it really, like, everything feels period perfect. And his color palette, I mean, in general, Joe Dante's in his movies is so kind of muted but also like vibrant. And it really, the way he uses like the Florida, you know, sunlight to do like one of the first shots in the movie when they're coming out of the theater for the first time, and the movie opens in the theater with them watching a coming attraction. When they walk out and it's, you know, the marquee of the Strand with Tales of Terror on the marquee, and it's the magic hour, and you've got that great Jerry Goldsmith music and the musical motif playing for the first time. It's that's the kind of thing that makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, this might be one of Jerry Goldsmith's best. I mean, it is one of his best scores, but I mean, yeah, it might be like his second or third best score. It was throughout, the music's so nice. I'm like, this is Jerry Goldsmith, really?
So it's so warm. It really has a feeling of like warmth and nostalgia for the period it's evoking, and then also, you know, the good crazy kind of carnival music that he did with the Gremlins movies is also there.
But the strange thing about how Dante presents the early 60s is that, yes, there's this sort of technicolor, sort of I Love Lucy in color thing to it for the first time, excitement. There's the prices and how they're different from now, and oh, remember how it was. But it's not like a positive. It's presented so factually that the person that I really think should see this the most, that I need to recommend it to, is more my dad, just because, you know, it really shouldn't have been missed by people who would have been interested in seeing it and then sort of didn't because of the reaction to it. Because it is this sort of just wonderful piece about the period. And yeah, it's a kid's movie, but I don't know. I mean, I don't think I'd want my kid watching that last scene before the action sequence. Just because that'd just be a weird conversation to have. Because I'm watching it going, yeah, that's a good point. Whoa, wait a second. She's like 12. What the hell's going on? But
yeah.
The thing that I also realized about it was when I was looking at the cast, and the only person I recognized from the cast was Stan, and I really think that must be some, like, he played on the Dallas show for like 10 years, and I think when I was a kid and saw Dallas, I must have remembered him somehow, because he's never been in anything else. Omri Katz. He was in the John Larroquette show, which I liked, but I certainly wouldn't have watched it enough to know who the heck he was. But the kid, it sort of brings up this interesting issue.
It's not like kids' movie, like, you know, single digit kids. These are kids who are like, what, I guess in their last year as a junior high or something.
Yeah, but the thing is that it's kind of strange that the child actors who sort of transition into adult actors,
yeah,
maybe shouldn't have. Maybe there's a difference between being a child actor and an adult actor, and maybe they shouldn't get to grow up. Maybe.
Yeah, well, I think Simon Fenton was pretty charming in this. He's kind of like he's kind of got a Doogie Howser look, but he's not completely obnoxious and full of shit. So.
Yeah, he wasn't obnoxious at all. And the scene where
have a career after this. Just looks like soap operas.
No, he's British. Oh. It was all British stuff. So maybe it was okay. I mean, who knows? He was in Band of Brothers. I mean,
but, oh, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. The scene where, and it's a great scene because, you know, Goodman's character sort of seems to be aware of what he does, very much aware of what he does, and that's what makes him a success. And that's what's kind of cool about Matinees, is it gives you a split second at the end where you forget that guys like his character did not become huge successes. Instead, it was, I mean, by this time, the Universal.
That's a very marked difference from like Ed Wood, which has the bravery to acknowledge the failure at the end. And it's both cases, it's like driving off into the sunset, driving off in a convertible car with your girl. But
I think, Ed Wood really does acknowledge the failure. But I think in this one, I don't think that it expected the audience to know that guys like that weren't going to make it.
Right, right.
It wasn't going to acknowledge that. Because that's, I mean, Ed Wood's ending is so, Ed Wood's ending is a profound sort of like, the world sucks type thing. Whereas Matinee is this sort of happy,
Matinee has some profundities, I think, but they're not summarized at the end of the movie. They're kind of in smaller doses throughout. But
I mean, the profundities at the end of the movie are, it seems like John Goodman's really hoping that his, 15-year-old friend has sex with his 14-year-old girlfriend soon. And it's never verbalized, but you're just kind of like, wow, that's just dumb.
Well, it was a different time. It was, 62.
Good for you, John Goodman's character, Lawrence Woolery, saying that.
It was a different era.
I totally lost. Oh, the scene that I really like is when, so Simon Fenn's character Gene is a big monster movie fan.
Yeah.
And he has all the monster movie magazines that
he is seen with famous monsters of filmland, yes.
Like, which one was it that got me thinking? London After Midnight, you know, that one, that famous shot of Lon Chaney from that. And, you know, the crazy thing is they didn't even know, probably in 92, that movie was lost when they were making the movie because nobody even looked for it. So they certainly wouldn't have known in 62. But there's the scene where he talks to John Goodman's character about how Vincent Price and guys like that are his friends.
That is the big profound scene of the movie, which I sometimes mention, touch upon when I'm trying to convince people to see this movie.
Because
it's kind of a,
And it's
something.
And then somehow John Goodman has this story to tell the kid that actually, it shouldn't. And this is the beauty of the script here, is that John Goodman's story shouldn't have anything to do with what the kid's talking about, but it does. And it's like John Goodman is such a salesman that he wouldn't have actually thought about making a relevant connection to the kid at that point, but he sort of does just by accident, because they're sort of those two characters who are in sync before they realize it. And it's a nice way to, and the really cool thing about that is that you really don't see those two characters. They have their big sort of long sequence together then.
And then they're not together pretty much for the rest of the movie.
Until the end of the movie, which is sort of told in real time, and it's a crisis and stuff like that. And it's just really impressive that...
And it's like, Goodman tells this scene that's inspired, in the scene he tells a story and it's inspirational, and it's about the movies and it's about their power and their magic. And, he's telling the kid this story because the kid said, hey, I recognized Dick Miller, just like Dick Miller probably used to get recognized as, hey, I've seen you in movies too. But, he's bringing the kid into the fold. And then later on, the screenplay does it one better when a few scenes later, he's talking to the Starkweather kid, the crazy guy played by James Villamere, and when he starts to show a little resistance, he's like, let me tell you a story, about the movies, and then the scene's over. So he's about to incorporate him with his inspirational story, And sort of you feel like he's that, you know at that moment how good he is at what he does, because like you as the audience were taken in along with Gene when he was taking Gene in with his speech.
Yeah, and the Starkweather thing is very interesting. I mean, that's just it. Matinee's so unexpected, I guess. Every sort of plot development is unexpected. Other than knowing the Cuban Missile Crisis was going to be over by the end, I really had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. And even the way they concluded it with the Cuban Missile Crisis wasn't how I expected them to conclude it with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's just sort of it, I mean, yeah, Gremlins 2 is really well written, but it's really well written in the way that Gremlins 2 is really well written.
Right, because Gremlins 2 is almost like a series of sketches.
Yeah, and that you know that they were like, hey, let's do this, this, and this. Like, it's that whole Raiders of the Lost Ark thing where the three guys throw down every scene they ever wanted to see in a movie and they turn it into a movie. That's Gremlins 2. This is totally different than that.
Right,
And,
this is a story with really well developed characters and really well developed relationships between them.
And for some reason, I was shocked that Joe Dante didn't have a story credit because I always thought that he did. Which just kind of makes the whole thing even weirder that Joe Dante didn't like come up with this, that it just sort of worked out these this whole thing coming together.
Well, they could have, after having done Gremlins 2, they could have been talking about this, and Joe Dante might not have came up with a story, but he could have been like, I want to do a period piece about going to the movies and something like that.
This really seems like the kind of thing that if Dante was ever going to cash in being friends with Spielberg, this would have been the one to get a little Spielberg heft behind it.
But I still feel like this is Steven Spielberg's like romanticism of the past and small town life and everything without being like full of shit. Because what you were saying earlier about how it's, there's references to the price of, groceries and stuff like that, but they're not shoving the period down your throat. They're showing it without that much difference. I think they're like trying to, besides the Cuban Missile thing, they're making the past analogous to the present and not ever like in a overstated way. It's just sort of showing like, people do go through their rituals pretty much the same way. And it's not at all like Back to the Future or something where the 50s is another planet and every few seconds it's like, whoa, that's how things used to be. Like Lisa Jacoub mentions very casually the fact that the black kids have to go to another school, for instance, and it's just a line of dialogue, but it's just part of the reality that the movie creates so well.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, I don't think
Well,
that.
reality within the bounds of a movie where Robert Picardo is a panicky theater owner
With a wonderful balding thing going on
with a
at the
petticoat.
end where it
With a
shows
petticoat.
up. That thing
Where
is amazing.
his hair suddenly
It's
poops
like a
out.
plate on top of his head.
And
Honestly,
he has slick and thick, and it's like,
I can't
wow.
see.
He's like a peacock.
Steven Spielberg, I mean, regardless of what movies he liked growing up, whatever, knowing to put William Shatner, or I can't believe you pronounce that like it's French, the dentist in Mant, who was the dad on the Patty Duke show and in so many of those 60s movies, and he was in Gremlins 2 maybe, or something, maybe not. But I can't think that Steven Spielberg would think to put that in because that's too referential of. It's too much of an homage to other people's work, and Spielberg doesn't really do that. Like, it's always about his thing sort of existing on its own without acknowledging that it needed something else. But I just meant that Matinee needed a push because it came out in 93. It was Universal. What time of year did it open? Let me see here. Oh, it opened in January. So no wonder.
Yeah, but Spielberg could have, I guess as busy as he might have been with Jurassic Park at that time, I could see this movie being promoted alongside Jurassic Park because, it's about going to a monster movie, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of. It could have been promoted alongside Jurassic Park as sort of being a highbrow. Sort of variation on that. Yeah, the trivia section for this movie on IMDb is really stupid, so I wouldn't suggest looking at it before you see the movie.
Does it say what a cartoon was playing on the television during one of the scenes in Mant? Because I was I noticed that, and I was like, "Wow, there really isn't a Joe Dante movie where he doesn't get an old black and white cartoon on a TV somewhere."
No, it says that it uses Woolsey International Pictures as an homage to American International,
Yeah, duh, yeah.
which sort of doesn't acknowledge the fact that Mant looked like a Universal International, or them, for that instance, with the exclamation point. And the sort of call out to Mara Corday is, I don't know,
There were a
shouldn't
lot
be.
more there were a lot more famous or not so famous B movie directors' names made into characters' names in this. Just
So
like the Howling with all its werewolf director names.
we're being a little bit too snobby for the IMDb trivia section here. And I mean, this is like I rarely ever wish something would come out in a Criterion edition anymore, just because since they moved over to DVD from Laserdisc, there's so many of them it doesn't really matter anymore. But Matinee is kind of one that, they made a frightening special edition. Why isn't there a Matinee special edition? I'm sure Dante would be willing to sit down and do a commentary on it for free. I'm sure he's got footage around.
You mean the Frighteners?
Did I say The Frightening?
Yeah.
Yeah, The Frighteners has that
Yeah.
7-hour Laserdisc
Oh, yeah, right. The
version.
four-hour director's cut.
No, it's not 4 hours. It's only like 10 minutes longer. And he doesn't even like want it to be called the director's cut because it's just supposed to be more fun. And I
Yeah.
don't think they ever wrote that on the DVD, but at one point, this is before Peter Jackson became whatever he's become. He said that the Fright, because I like The Frighteners. I mean, it's a fine, diverting, what it seems like a movie that Joe Dante would have produced. But he referred to the special edition as the director's fun cut. That he just threw in the fun stuff. And it's just kind of like Universal did those signature collection Laserdiscs that some of them became DVDs, some of them
Yeah.
didn't. But it seems like Matinee would have been a good thing to do just because, I don't know. It's
Yeah,
not like
it's
Universal had a bunch of great movies from the early 90s. I mean,
Yeah. Yeah,
Street Fighter, The Hard Way, I mean, come on.
this Yeah. No, this is the culmination of a lot of Joe Dante's themes. In a way that, it's comparable to Ed Wood again because Tim Burton, like Joe Dante, you think of as a genre director, and this is essentially their non-genre drama, and yet it's a drama about genre, and it has a lot of it has a lot of beautiful aspects to it, both films do, I think, for the same reasons that they're dramas made by genre directors about genres, and they have these kind of larger than life characters. Although, in Matinee, it's not so much larger than life as just, it's not easy to think that kids are real kids in movie, but these kids feel like they're real kids, and they kind of the things around them are kind of bigger than life. There was when they're Joe Dante's collective interests, like breaking the way Lawrence Woolsey's promoted is to break the fourth wall for moviegoers. That's Dante already and the screenwriters did that with Gremlins 2 by having the theater projector break, and wanting people to, you know, run out and complain the way people run out of Mant. You know, the kids going rowdy in the theater reminds me of Gremlins. Just the, I don't know, Joe Dante kind of uses the movie theater itself as an important location in his movies, even in The Howling, where you've got a porno theater, but the thing of a projected image on the screen. John Goodman's monologue that we were talking about with the kid is, it's, I don't know, it's like Cinema Paradiso or any of those. It's way up there. It's just about a different era of movie appreciation. And I know you mean about this, like, you know, Joe Dante seeming to have a story credit because everything you know about the guy pretty much seems to correlate and, you know, to Gene's experiences in the movie, like knowing the movie actors, like, you know, the way, and the insider references are just too specific, you know. It's like he probably, you know, the casting of Sales and Dick Miller as the goon promoters for Woolsey, it's like, you know, Gene recognizes Dick Miller because Dick Miller's been in movies, and like Dick Miller is the kind of actor who has the kind of face that you recognize in B movies, and that's why Joe Dante started putting him in his movies. So yeah. there's just all it's like the more of a Joe Dante fan, the better this movie is.
Well, I think also that having Sales in it in 93 is completely different than having Sales in, say, The Howling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I just saw Sales in some movie. Ugh, what was it? It was the Tommy Lee Jones one that went direct-to-video here, and supposedly the French cut of it's 20 minutes longer and really good, and the version that came out here is crappy. It's called In Confederate Mist, or Into the Confederate Mist, or with something like that. I mean, Sales in 93 would have been pretty close to being on the top of his sort of recognition, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That having him in it, you would think people would pay attention to this, and I'd never heard of it. You know, in the span of 1993 to now, and finding the man, it's just like it kind of got totally forgotten, and it's
I'm surprised it wasn't a video hit, because I thought, like, the image on the VHS box of John Goodman smiling in front of the atomic mushroom cloud was, like, pretty striking, pretty attention-grabbing when it was on, and you'd see it on the shelves in your video stores.
No, because you could tell that it was a period piece, and really, when's the last time period pieces were successful?
Yeah.
Like 83, what, The Outsiders, and that was because it was big with teenage girls. So it's like, it's just unfortunate that, and this is really the younger kid growing up genre.
Yeah.
Doesn't have a lot of standouts. I mean, besides this, I really can't think of anything.
Yeah, I agree. It's the only good one.
Because once you start getting a little bit older, you get to American Graffiti, which is about totally different things and totally different experience. And this is, I mean, what's the comparison to this? It's kind of like the Monster Squad, if the Monster Squad had been good. I mean...
Nah, it's a far cry from that.
Because it's also this very... it's very interesting sort of discussion of young adolescent male friendship too, between Stan and Gene. I mean, the scene where they're at the theater, it's, you know, where they have to talk to each other and apologize, and Stan has to apologize. Yeah. It's kind of profound in that, you know, you don't really see this a lot, and it's not acknowledged. And I think the movie that really sort of probably ruined it for any future film is Superbad by turning it into by making it obvious at the end, even though it was effective, I think it's super bad. It sort of ruined this unspoken sort of buddy movie thing that, you know, they have this.
Like you're saying, the three main characters really are Gene and his friend and John Goodman, because Gene and his friends are, it seems like they, you know, they're kind of giving each other a hard time at first, and their relationship is really well developed. And they have these two girls in their lives, but the two girls are like almost cartoon characters by comparison. Like, you know, the goody, and they're hilarious too. You know, the goody two shoes girl who used to go out with Starkweather, the Hood, and, you know, she was given her sexual awakening by him, and now she's horny all the time. And then, the girl who's this intellectual and like future beat, or, you know, her parents were beatniks, basically, the one played by Lisa Jacoub. And they're, you know, even though the movie ends with Gene and Lisa Jacoub on the beach, it's still, it is more like Simon Fenton and Omri Katz's story.
She really gets a little bit more fleshed out in that sort of crisis scene they have.
Oh yeah, Jacoub, yeah.
Yeah. But Kelly Martin is totally, I mean, she's absurd and hilarious the whole time. Yeah. And it's just so funny because she's just so
well, this movie, like, you know, it has all these archetypes almost, and then it just turns them on their head, and they're not predictable in the way of like the Wonder Years and stuff like that. Like, you know, the greaser or, you know, who reads his poetry and stuff. And his name's Starkweather, you know, obviously. But, you know, like, their mom is has her unique character traits. And, yeah, nothing is, you know, everything is kind of archetypal, but nothing's really what you expect. Like, even, and there's kind of a, you know, very, very funny luridness to it sometimes. Like, Kelly Martin's little brother bribing, extorting the monster movie from her by threatening to show their parents her dirty love letters to Starkweather in prison or in the juvenile hall.
Yeah.
It's really funny. Yeah. Really funny stuff.
And that's kind of what's interesting about how it sort of roams, not really having a set protagonist, because Starkweather's sort of a big character on his own for a little bit at the end of, I guess, what would be the second act. And it's just kind of all very organic, and it's all very nice. And,
yeah, it's very true. Yeah, it's sort of like characters don't get, there aren't quite main characters so much as like screen time. And even, you know, the villains have scenes that are character scenes, like where John Sayles and Dick Miller almost punch him, which is awesome.
Yeah, that is a great scene. I'd never been that scared of Dick Miller before.
I was telling you, this is like the one movie where he gets to be a tough guy.
Because all the other times he's like the sweet old grandpa.
Right.
Like, be like, hey, I got some candy for ya. Because I think in every other role he ever had, some but he brought their kid up to him and he gave him some candy. I mean, it just seems like it.
Well, you know, did you ever see Bucket of Blood?
No. I have actually not seen... The first Dick Miller movie I would have seen would probably have been The Howling or whatever.
Well, you gotta see Bucket of Blood sometime.
So...
Oh, yeah. Did you notice Naomi Watts in the Shook Up Shopping Cart?
I did notice Naomi Watts in that...
The Shook Up Shopping Cart. Oh my god.
Which really got me thinking about, you know,
another awesome movie with the other awesome movie within a movie of this movie is the early 60s Disney-esque live action comedy genre that drove people to movies like Mant instead.
She's so perfect in that it's sort of, it actually made me...
Her Britishness really fits perfectly.
It made me forgive her for King Kong. In a way, I'm like, wait a second, I need to see her in something else again. Like, this is all right. And obviously when they cast her, it was not intentional that we would someday be sitting around discussing her in those terms. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a fun little... It's like Herbie, only a shopping cart.
Yes.
And I actually didn't know it was fake until I realized it was her, because whoever the guy was just perfect.
Right, another very period kind of straight man, leading man in a dopey comedy like that.
So, yeah. The DVD's still in print, I think, or maybe mm-hmm. it isn't. I don't know.
Yeah, it is, but there's no rediscovery in sight yet. So, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Matinee, you should see it.
Is it available on Instant Watch?
On Netflix? I don't think so. Yeah, I think, isn't it on TV occasionally? Pay channels? It's definitely on Netflix. And this is a must watch. I mean, forget if you're a Joe Dante fan. If you're a fan of movies about childhood or young love or the love of watching movies or, you know, friendship during that time in your life.
Or if you just want to see good 14-year-old actors for the first time ever,
yeah, there's that. All those things incorporated by that, or made possible by that, I should say. So, yeah. Next week we're going to be talking about Oliver Stone's. I'm sure it's not his worst movie, but I only say it because I haven't seen all of Oliver Stone's movies. But this one is, I think, one of the funniest bad ones. It's Talk Radio from 1988, and it's kind of demagoguery about Howard Stern and Howard Stern imitators from a guy who never saw a trendy crisis of the headlines he couldn't exploit, Oliver Stone.
And then for the good movie, we will be watching Wages of Fear, which is directed by someone whose name I can't remember, the guy who made Diabolique. And Wages of Fear was remade as Sorcerer, which I don't know if you've seen, but
81 or something.
Oh, 77. Oh. There's great stories about Sorcerer too, because it was back in the late 70s period when all those guys were friends. And so, I don't remember where I read it, but it was in some book about how, you know, somebody couldn't go see Star Wars. You know, mm-hmm. Lucas was flying people out to see Star Wars, and Billy Friedkin couldn't see Star Wars because he was too busy cutting Sorcerer. Sorcerer might have been one of the first Tangerine Dream scores that sort of, you know, hung around for 10 years.
Yeah.
But Wages of Fear is just fantastic, fantastic stuff. And, yeah. So.
Cool, and I haven't seen that, and you haven't seen Talk Radio, right?
I haven't seen Talk Radio since I was...
Oh, yeah, since you were a lad.
16, probably, you know? And I think I actually owned the Pan and Scan Laserdisc and never watched it.
Okay, well...
So I'll be enjoying it in widescreen. Some Oliver Stone... pre-Wall Street. No, it was the first one after Wall Street, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, it's been a pet project.
If it's worse than Wall Street or Platoon, I don't know if I'm going to dislike it that much, because Charlie Sheen's not in it. Playing Ollie, or whatever his character's names were.
I think I'll still have a laugh. So,
oh, I'm sure I will.
Until then, this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. Check out our WordPress, alansmithypodcast.wordpress.com, and we will see you next week. This has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
Good night.